On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's check with Meredith Colius-Pete, who is a reporter for the Post Tribune, on the stories that she has put out there online and in print these days. And Meredith, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start in first with a very interesting story that you got to hear at a recent seminar in Valparaiso from people that you wouldn't necessarily connect with the issue of suicide. But Mariel Hemingway came in to speak at an organization event. Tell us about that.
Sure. Mariel Hemingway, as folks probably know, is the granddaughter of Ernest Hemingway, the famous writer, the sister of supermodel Marco Hemingway, and she's a famous actress in her own right. She came and she was the keynote speaker. It was the 6th annual suicide prevention conference at BU that was held last Friday in Valparaiso. And, you know, in recent years, she's really become a suicide prevention advocate in her own right. Folks listening, of course, probably know that the Hemingway family is unfortunately famous for a lot of tragedies that have happened in the family. She says that there's been about 7 members in her family that have committed suicide. So it's definitely a cause that's near and dear to her heart. The conference was really fascinating because she sort of came in and talked about her upbringing and her own family's experience with suicide, and definitely said that that was not something that they talked about growing up. Mm-hmm. Did not talk about some of her other sisters' struggles with mental illness. And so it's really something that she really feels very strongly should be put out there and put into the light, and things that people should talk about so that you can cut down on some of the stigma that it has in society. Her audience were basically mental health counselors, so it was kind of her sharing a lot of her personal experiences so that they could use to go back and sort of be better practitioners for their own clients.
Mm-hmm. During any of the conversation come up her mentioning about the fact that her grandfather, of course, the famous novelist Ernest Hemingway, certainly was had a problem himself with depression and taken his own life, I guess, the same way too. So I suppose that's why there's this family link, unfortunately, to depression and to mental health problems, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And she talked about her grandfather, a little bit. I mean, he sort of famously, committed suicide on his ranch. And, of course, her sister, Margot Hemingway, supermodel, very tragically committed suicide as well back in about 1996. So she did really talk about the family connection. And I think that Mariel has said that it was important for her to sort of come to terms with the family link, between all these things, and because she sort of said that she, she wants her own children to sort of have as healthy a life and outlook as possible, and she kind of said, half jokingly, that she kind of wants them to have their own problems that don't involve, the family struggles with mental illness and addiction and suicide.
Well, sounds like it was a very interesting conference and a very interesting conversation that Ms. Hemingway had with everybody over in Valparaiso. One of the other stories that you had out there in print online in the Post Tribune is luckily dealing with a topic that is very big interest in Northwest Indiana. It's not involved mental health issues. It's involving education, though. And State Senator Eddie Melton and a special guest came over for a recent town hall meeting that he held over in Hammond. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Eddie Melton came about a week ago to Hammond. He's been doing these listening tours all through the state. He's formed an exploratory committee, so he's sort of weighing whether or not he wants to run for governor. There's been no official announcement yet. So he was joined by Jennifer McCormick, which is the head of the Indiana Department of Education. So they're doing this sort of, like I said, listening tour where they're sort of asking questions of the audience and kind of seeing the things that they're eyeballing or they're worrying about in education. Jennifer McCormick is a sort of a lame duck, where she's Indiana's last elected head of the Indiana Department of Education. So she sort of, since she announced that she wasn't running for re-election, she's been, I think, a little bit more frank in her own mind about mm-hmm. well, they've both been pretty critical of, I guess, the landscape of education in Indiana.
Yeah, they've been very concerned about the shortage of teachers in Indiana, very concerned about teacher pay and other issues as well, too. Any kind of thing come up in discussion, not only from Senator Melton or from Ms. McCormick, but also from the folks who attended the town hall meeting that night?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of familiar faces, definitely, in the audience. I mean, it was a lot of school superintendents locally and school members and teachers who are very sort of active politically and that sort of thing. You know, a lot of the issues that we've heard over and over again the past couple of years, you know, McCormick has said that she feels like the finances, all the financial issues right now that are going around in education are the ones that are sort of really talking about the oxygen and putting the focus there, where she feels like the focus should be on like what kids are being taught and teacher training and stuff like that. You know, you have these sort of broad financial issues where a lot of school districts, public school districts, are saying that they've been very strapped for cash, you know, the past decade plus. You know, teachers aren't getting raises, things like that. The school districts are having to go to property tax owners to do tax referendums to get more money for their budget. And so those are the kinds of things that you would expect that really, really came up. The teacher shortage issue is a real issue for a lot of districts going right now, and that's something that, you know, Melton definitely had out there. Governor Holcomb has put together sort of a teacher pay commission that you know, beginning, I think, this month to kind of hold town hall meetings and stuff like that. But a lot of critics have pointed out that there's only one teacher on that commission that's actually working as a teacher, and a lot of those folks that have been appointed seem to have some ties to Holcomb himself.
One of the other stories, and a very interesting one, too, that you've had in more in-depth here in the Post-Tribune lately, Meredith, is one about a topic that is going to come up here with the start of the next season of speakers for the Purdue University Northwest Sinai Forum. I think maybe nobody seems to think there may be maybe they're just dazzled by the celebrity status of the people that are coming in to speak, but they don't think about how much it actually costs the Sinai Forum to be able to bring these folks into Westville, or in the least in the case of some of them, to Michigan City. Tell us what you found out in your discoveries.
Yeah, absolutely. And for anyone that's not familiar, the Sinai Forum is Purdue University Northwest's longtime speaker series. You know, each year they bring in sort of people in the news and to kind of just have them do a little talk and things like that. This year, it looks like they're bringing in folks like, you know, John Kelly, who used to be President Trump's chief of staff in the White House, Alan Dershowitz, who's a famous lawyer, Gloria Steinem, Captain Sullenberger, who landed the plane on the Hudson River a couple years back and saved everybody on board. So basically what we found from a public records request is that a lot of these guys are getting a pretty good payout from the Sinai Forum, about $50,000 or more for their speech. And, you know, this comes even a couple months after Purdue Northwest put out an internal report sort of looking at where they're spending money and seeing, you know, where they can sort of, you know, kind of clean up shop and save money here and there. Mm-hmm. And part of it was critical of the Sinai Forum, and it said that perhaps that it needs to do more to get grants and sort of, you know, pick up the cost of some of its expenses. And now you have, you know, here John Kelly, Dershowitz, and Gloria Steinem, as we found out, are getting paid $50,000 or more each for their appearances.
Are you finding out in the research that you did for your article if there are grants that are out there, if there are sponsors out there that are helping pay some of the costs of bringing the speakers into Northwest Indiana and putting them up for the day or the night, whichever the case may be?
That's an excellent question, and I'm not sure at all. So mm-hmm. I'm not quite entirely sure, you know, sure where all the money is coming from. The Sinai Forum obviously has you know, several sponsors that, you know, include the Blue Chip Casino, where John Kelly's speech is going to be held. And it also includes, obviously, the Times. And part of Kelly's contract, it looks like, is requiring him to do an interview with the Times, which, you know, does raise some ethics questions and whether or not the Times is essentially paying for an interview with John Kelly.
Yeah.
So, To answer your question, I'm not entirely sure.
Well, I'm sure that they have some help they have to, and it's just a matter of finding out or if revealing, I suppose, coming forth and say that we're getting some underwriters, so to speak, just as public broadcasting has for programs and the like. So I guess we'll find out eventually what happens there. But just the same, I suppose we're probably glad that they're able to bring such high-profile people into Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, and that's correct. Absolutely. And, folks will get something out of it, for sure. The interesting thing about John Kelly, and I've kind of heard this from folks, is we were expecting that there may be some protests, obviously when he gives a speech at the Blue Chip, at this point. Their contracts, especially with Kelly and Dershowitz, Purdue has to pay up. They can't cancel these speakers. So unless the speakers themselves cancel, then Purdue's kind of on the hook for this money. John Kelly's appearance, for some folks is controversial. After he left the White House, he was named to the board of Caliburn International, which is a company that is helping to run some of the larger migrant child detention facilities in Texas and Florida. Dershowitz himself has ties to New York investment banker Jeffrey Epstein, who's been in the news lately. He's been arrested and charged with running a child sex ring. In federal court filings, at least one woman that has alleged that Dershowitz participated in it with at least one or two women. So these folks, at least two of these folks, have some controversy tied to their name at this point.
Well, we know they always like to have some kind of a Q&A session after the speech that is held there at the Sinai Forum each weekend, Sundays when they usually have them. I'm sure there'll be some questions that won't be able to get asked because they're involving matters that are still involved in the courts, but still it would be fun to find out if they would happen to ask a question, even if you couldn't get an answer, I suppose. Well, Meredith, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about the stories, in particular the Sinai Forum stories that you managed to get, working out the information on the public records request that you made to find out all these tidbits about the speakers coming in. And we appreciate you being with us today and hope to have you back on Regionally Speaking again soon.
Thanks for having me.
Continuing on with Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, we talk with Hannah Reed. She's an intern with the Post Tribune, and she's come out with a very interesting, if not surprising, story, maybe to some, about how birth rates in Northwest Indiana seem to have changed over the last decade. Hannah, first off, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, tell us first how you got your information together and give us more about what you've discovered about birth rates and how they seem to be on the decline here in the region.
Okay, so I read a story on the Denver Post about how birth rates and fertility rate in Colorado had declined. And so I was curious about how it had declined in Indiana, both the state as a whole and Northwest directly, just to see how it affected where we are. And I went on statsindiana.org, and I found that in Indiana as a whole, the births from 2007 to 2017 were down by 7,000. So I decided to go a little bit deeper and see, Lake and Porter counties, how are they doing? And so I figured out from 2007 to 2017, it was down over 1,000 births. And I just thought it was something that was super interesting, and so I wanted to talk to people in the area to see what they thought about it, or people who were childless by choice or were going to be childless by choice, what they were thinking about the whole thing.
Tell us about some of the people that you did talk to. I know one of them in particular is an important academician at IU Northwest, and Gary, the lady who's the director of Women's and Gender Studies on the Gary campus. Tell us what she had to say and why she felt that the having children was not to her choice.
Right. So I talked to Dr. Foltz, the director of Women's and Gender Studies at Indiana University Northwest, and she is also childless by choice, and that was something that I didn't know even going into the interview. I originally just wanted to talk to her because she was the director of Women's and Gender Studies, and I thought maybe she would have some insight into the topic.
Right.
But she ended up telling me, she was childless by choice. She's been happily divorced since the 1990s, and her reasoning behind it was just because she said at the time when she was married, her and her husband wanted to be able to travel and wanted to be able to do other things without having, children to put into daycare or take care of or do that type of thing. And she did say it wasn't because, she said she loves children, you know, it wasn't because she doesn't like children. It was just not something in her that she felt she needed to fulfill.
And I understand, too, you talk to some young couples, too, so it's not just some thought of some people who are mature adults, it's younger adults as well, too, I understand.
Yeah, I talked to a girl, Nikki Jones, from Dyer, and she is, I believe, 23, she said, and her and her fiancé, Jake, he has kids from different relationships, mm-hmm. So she's going to be like a stepmother to these children, but she said she's helped raise them, and that has, in part, you know, I guess satisfied the maternal instincts that she had. And so for that reason, you know, she's saying from now on, like, kids aren't really in the picture, although she didn't think that they were in the first place, because she said in the past she never really wanted kids. She wanted to be able to travel and, like, have independence and, you know, do all that type of stuff, which you can do when you have kids, but it's a little bit more difficult. So she said that her fiance having kids, you know, has solidified her want to not have them herself. And she said at the most she'd probably be a foster parent, just because she believes that the world is overpopulated already and these kids in foster care don't get the attention that they deserve, and she wants to be able to help the community but not add to the community, like, physically.
I wonder, too, if it isn't also a concern that women may have, and maybe you found out in putting together your story for the Post-Tribune online and in print, that it turns out that there's maybe a bias out there against women that have children that are out there in the job market right now?
Right. So Dr. Foltz did say that, you know, sometimes women who have a family are seen as not as serious. They're seen as people who are going to need special hours so they can be with their kids at certain times, or seen as people who are going to need to leave work to go, like, pick up a kid when they're sick or something of that sort.
Right.
And they're seen as not wanting to put in extra hours because they have children at home, versus, you know, men who have children, that never really seems to be something that they have to deal with in the workplace. And it also is this expectation with women that Dr. Foltz said the expectation is that whether or not they have children now, they're able to have children in the future, and that means that, you know, the company's going to need to process maternity leave and find someone to take their spot. So even if women are not planning on having children, they're seen as someone who could need this time off if they do.
Is there a concern that maybe the researchers have noted, or maybe we'll find out in the future, about the fact that the birth rate drops in Indiana, and that it's going to have an impact not only on families, the size of families, but it'll have an impact on the job market as well?
I didn't see any concern about that. One of the things I did see was the fact that women are waiting later in life to have their children, mm-hmm. So the fertility rate has gone down along with the birth rate, and what that means is the fertility rate is the rate in which women are usually expected to have children. So between, like, 15 and 44 is the fertility rate, and the birth rate is, you know, the number of births that are happening. And so what I saw in my research was that women were waiting until their late 30s or early 40s to have their children versus, you know, having them at, like, 26 or 27. Or just choosing not to have children at all, which decreases both the fertility and the birth rate.
So do you see that there may be, although it maybe seem flippant to say so, that there are pros and cons in waiting before having children?
Yeah, I talked to Dr. Foltz about pros and cons. And one of the pros that she noted was, you know, you can have economic stability, mm-hmm. and not have to worry about, you know, spending money on a child or saving for a child education, or, you know, putting money into them, as well as being able to focus on your job and, like, go forward in your profession and achieve goals that are not impossible to do if you have children, but do seem a little bit more difficult. And so, like, there are also cons in waiting, though, because, you know, Dr. Foltz said most of the cons have to do with health complications, and the fact that it's more difficult to physically have a child without complications as women age, just because, you know, when you're waiting, your body at 26 is a lot different than your body at 42. So it's not like it's impossible, but there are different health complications.
That sounds like a lot of interesting and maybe to some people alarming facts that have come out as a result of the study that you did in your research that you've done, as well as the story that's out there in the Post Tribune online and in print. And let me ask Hannah, since you're a reporter intern at least, you're getting into the field of journalism, what did your editors think about the idea you probably had to pitch to them about this and the story that's come out?
Yes, so as an intern, I kind of try to pitch stories that I think are, you know, I take them from national news and I kind of pull them to Northwest Indiana. Mm-hmm. So I think I was really excited to pitch this idea just because I thought it was a really exciting topic to look into, and my editor seemed excited to have it. So, yeah, it got a lot of positive feedback.
That's good to hear. Well, Hannah, thank you for sharing your information with us and the story that you put out there in the Post Tribune in print and online concerning the decline of birth rates in Northwest Indiana, and the research in the comments you got locally as well, too, from folks that had some very definite viewpoints about it. And we hope to have you back on again soon.
Thank you for having me.
Hannah Reed is an intern for the Post Tribune. There are now two Safe Haven baby boxes here in Northwest Indiana. The latest has been set up at Franciscan Health in Hammett. And the person who set up the first one, and in turn all of the Safe Haven baby boxes, was at Michigan City when the first here in Northwest Indiana was established. It was set up in Michigan City as an opportunity for new mothers who wish to give their newborn child away legally and in a place that is safe for the baby. Indiana's Safe Haven law enables a person to give up an unwanted infant anonymously without fear of arrest or prosecution. And the anonymity of the Safe Haven baby box is a last resort for some women in crisis. Monica Kelsey was the founder and CEO of Safe Haven Baby Boxes. She set up the organization out of her own experience, and she told Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson when the Michigan City Baby Box was established that bringing a baby box to Franciscan Health was a long time coming.
We've been actually working with Franciscan Health for the last 3 years. Once we put a box in Cold Springs, Franciscan is all about, they value life. They wanted to be a part of this. So we've been working with them for 3 years. We knew that they had to build their hospital first. So this is a great opportunity for us to partner with them to not only bring more baby boxes to the state of Indiana, but to also value life with their help. So we're super excited about this.
So I was going to ask why it took 3 years. Is it because they had to build the hospital first?
Yeah, they had the other hospital, and then they knew that they were moving out of that hospital. We didn't want to install in that old hospital, so we just waited for them to do the new hospital. And in the meantime, while they were building that hospital, we've had two babies in Cold Springs Fire Department right there in Michigan City. Plus, we had a handoff safe surrender back in April of last year, so three babies have come from LaPorte County just since we installed the baby boxes at Cold Springs. So we knew that we needed another box in that area.
I was reading your story about you and how you came to create this. Can you go ahead and share that with us?
Absolutely. Back in 1972, when abortion was illegal in our country, a 17-year-old girl was brutally attacked. She was raped. She was left along the side of the road. She pressed charges against the man who had raped her, and he was arrested and charged. And if that wasn't the worst of it, she finds out she's pregnant 6 weeks later. And at the advice of her mother, she found herself at a back alley abortion facility in October of 1972. And while standing in front of the man that was going to take her child's life, this 17-year-old girl changed her mind. And she was hidden for the remainder of the pregnancy. She gave birth in April of 73 and abandoned her child 2 hours after that child was born. And that child was me. So I am, by all accounts, an unwanted child being conceived in rape and abandoned at birth. But every child is wanted by someone. And I want these women to know that there are options for these children. And there's no shame, there's no blame when you choose the Safe Haven law. These children's lives can go on, and so can the mother's life go on with no shame. So I started Safe Haven Baby Boxes because of my own story. And I believe that such a time as this, these boxes are needed, especially with everything that's happening across this country with the abortion laws.
How did your life turn out? How do you feel about what had happened, how you were brought into the world?
It definitely was a shock when I found out. I was 37 years old. I was an adult, so it was a blessing that I was older when I actually got to meet my biological mother and view the reports and stuff. But I really kind of had to dig a little bit deeper than normal, because I had to find myself and find my worth. And unfortunately, people in society today make us feel, or make me feel sometimes, that I'm unworthy of even life. And what happened back in 1972 was not my fault. It had nothing to do with me. I was a victim of that crime as well. And the fact that my birth mother was strong enough to carry me to term, I think speaks volumes about the love that these mothers have for their children. And getting to meet me 37 years later, she never had any more children after me, which is very common with rape victims. And being able to reconnect with me 37 years later, she got to see that the daughter that she saved is now saving others.
How is your relationship with your birth mother? Do you both have an ongoing relationship?
I got to spend about 3 years with her before she passed away. And the relationship that we had was amazing. She wondered about me her entire life growing up, and every birthday she actually baked me a cake, and that was how she honored me. And it was just such a blessing to get to know her and to get to know her heart. And I think that was what gave me empathy that I needed to be able to work with women today who don't choose good options, and push me a little bit harder to make sure that these women know of all the positive options that are out there.
So is Safe Haven, does it have anything to do with abortion laws and trying to encourage women not to have abortions? Or is it just simply the focus of just giving women an out?
We don't classify ourselves as pro-life or pro-choice simply because we want to help any woman that comes to us. And the women that come to us are in their final days of pregnancy, or they have just given birth to a baby and they're sitting on their bathroom floor and they're in crisis mode. Those are the women who are calling our hotlines wanting to know what they can do legally to make sure that they don't get in trouble criminally and that their child's life can go on. So we don't look at this as an abortion debate at all. This is a child who has been born, that is living, breathing, that just deserves his right to life just like anyone else does. We're simply trying to give these mothers another option. We want to be able to help these moms, and if it's a parenting plan that we help her with, or an adoption plan that we help her with, or a safe surrender that we help her with, we want to do what's best for her, let her make that decision what's best for her, and then make sure that she follows the law according to that so that she doesn't end up in prison. And we don't want women to find themselves in this situation. There are better options than this. And those children deserve to be placed in a safe place where fire and medical can arrive quickly, assess the child, and take the child to the hospital.
And I understand that getting the word out about Safe Haven is one of your big goals. And another one of your big goals is to get Safe Haven baby boxes in all 50 states.
The goal, of course, is in all 50 states within 2025. One of the things that a lot of people don't realize is baby boxes is a visual. Right now, you have no visual. If I ask somebody about the Safe Haven law, they can't say, oh, isn't it that box at the fire station that's on the side of the building? They can't say that unless there's a box at the side of a fire station in their town. But those boxes that are in these fire stations and in these hospitals is a constant reminder that the Safe Haven law is alive and well. Our goal is to never have a woman choose one of our baby boxes. And that's crazy, I know, to say when we're pushing these so hard, but the better option is a parenting plan or an adoption plan, or walking into a facility and handing a child over. February 22nd of this past year, we had a woman walk to a fire station that was going to place her child in one of our boxes. This fire station had a Safe Haven baby box, and she decided, with the help of us, to hand that child to a person. That is what we recommend. But having these boxes in the side of fire stations and hospitals is a constant reminder of the Safe Haven law. Whereas right now, if I don't tell you about it, you're not going to know about it, because people just don't Google Safe Haven law 1999 when the law was enacted. They find themselves in a crisis and they freak out. And hopefully, with us putting boxes in these fire stations, they can say, you know what? I remember a box in the fire station off 108th Street in Carmel, Indiana. I can take my child there, no questions asked, and turn around and walk away, and it's completely legal. That's our goal for the education and awareness. And then, of course, getting into the schools and educating these girls and boys on safe surrenders and what a good option is.
That's Monica Kelsey, who's the founder and CEO of Safe Haven Baby Boxes. And Lakeshore Public Radio, Sharon Jackson, talked with Monica after establishing the baby Safe Haven Baby Box at Michigan City at Franciscan Health. And now another's been established here in Lake County at Franciscan Health in Hammond. and she had a chance to talk with Monica after establishing the Michigan City Box. And after talking with people in the border town of Progreso, Mexico, recently, Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson went to the U.S.-Canadian border to learn more about people's experiences going in and out of the country there.
When Trump took over, we were asked a lot more questions and treated a lot differently.
In the aftermath of families getting separated at the U.S.-Mexico border, Lakeshore Public Radio traveled to the U.S.-Canada border to see how the environment is there. It was in Niagara Falls, Ontario, Canada, where I talked to people about their experiences crossing the border from the U.S. into Canada and Canada into the U.S. Me and my travel partner, Denise Dougherty, are in line at the border getting ready to cross into Canada. There didn't appear to be anyone trying to cross illegally. There weren't any tent camps or people hanging around, and families weren't getting separated, as far as I could see.
So we're on the Rainbow Bridge.
This is Border Patrol, much different than New Mexico's.
Right. Sure. I don't see any armed guards or anything around here, any wall or anything.
No.
What is that? Okay, so there's that guy at the gate. One, two. Can't see three, four, five, probably six cars back.
There were vehicles waiting in line from all over the United States, indicated by the license plates.
There's a camera on them, on each car, looking at the back of the car. Well, there's a Texas plate up there, Louisiana, Ontario, New York. You see them?
Yeah. And it's finally our turn to meet with the Border Services officer into Canada.
Hello? How are you? Sure. Brookfield, Illinois, Chicagoland area. Tourist, just to see it. Come to see the falls.
How long have you
been? A couple days till Thursday.
You guys have a hotel or somewhere?
Yeah, we're over at the Embassy Suites. By Hilton.
Any firearms or weapons coming up?
No.
Alcohol or tobacco?
We do have a Pabst Blue Ribbon back there.
Just one can?
A couple cans, all in a box. Thanks.
Thank you.
Oh, excuse me.
I put it in park, I'm sorry.
Okay.
We have to exit.
All right.
On the Canada side of Niagara Falls, there were people from all over the world. I saw black people, Indian people, Asians, Muslims, Eastern Europeans, Americans, and Canadians, just to name a few. We work our way down to the falls by way of the Falls Incline Railway to enjoy the view and to talk to people.
Can I get two all days?
I know, we did the same thing. $24,000, please. Yeah, there you go. If you have chip, it'll be chip.
Chip? In there?
Oh, just the other way around.
In there, right.
And then just the green button.
Cool. Okay, here you go.
You can take your
time. The Falls Incline Railway is widely used and is a good place to engage people in conversation.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Yep,
you too. So you guys are from the States?
Yes. Right around New York.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, we live in Bayonne, New Jersey. It's about 10 minutes away from New York. You guys?
I'm actually from the Chicago area.
Okay.
Not South person. Chicago, huh?
No.
Okay.
No.
Kind of. Got family there.
Middle.
I'm actually a reporter.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
You guys mind if I talk to you?
I don't care.
Are you here on an assignment?
So I initiate my first interview with a man named Luis Medina.
And you're from where?
I'm originally from Puerto Rico. My family's from Puerto Rico. I was born and raised in New York City.
So what was it like crossing the border from the U.S. into Canada for you?
A lot different than I thought. I thought it was going to be something like going across the Canadian border, or the Mexican border. And it wasn't. It was easy. They just, nobody there. We went right into the, talked to the cop. We checked out our passports, asked us where we were from, if the plates in the car was from the state we live in. Then he asked me about a police badge that I have on my windshield. Asked me if I was in law enforcement. I told him no. And simple. It wasn't a horrible experience. It was a good experience going through the border. Yeah.
So what did you see? What did you see? What kind of differences did you see when you were in Mexico or the Mexican border?
No, I never been to Mexico. What I just see in the programs, how they show that they stop the cars and always looking for drugs and stuff like that, contraband. They didn't do any of that. They didn't have no dogs searching the car, nothing like that. Just wanted to look inside the car, what we got. That's about it.
Marilyn LaRue from Binbrook, Ontario, Canada, has been to the States several times, and she says these days crossing the border into the United States is a little more complicated.
So how was it for you crossing the border into the States, and when was the last time you were there?
We were there just about 6 months ago, and if we don't fly in, that we use usually this border or Fort Erie.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What did they ask you, and how were you treated?
Oh. The last couple of times that we went, when we had our old passport, we had Egypt on the passport stamped, right? Because we went to Egypt, and all of a sudden they started asking us, after like a couple of years of it being there, they asked us, why did you go to Egypt? Where did you go? What were you doing? And that, like, remember?
What about Al Trudeau?
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that's why. Ever since Trump took over, they started asking different questions.
So would you go back to the States nowadays?
I'm going back. Actually, I'm flying out next Tuesday, and we're going in for 2 weeks to Florida, and then we're coming back, and then we're going to the Poconos with these guys, and then we're coming back, and then I'm going to Pennsylvania and West Virginia. We have really good friends there. And then I'm coming back, and then we're going back into Michigan.
Do you anticipate anything? Any difficulty coming over?
I hope not. This is the last time we flew in, we didn't have too much trouble, but that was when Trump wasn't in power. We went and we were flying all over the place, but this is the first time we've flown in. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping not, because I'm taking my 4-year-old grandchild with me, so I hope there's no trouble.
John, who is a young-looking Caucasian man originally from Hong Kong, came to visit Niagara Falls from where he now lives in South Africa.
What brings you to the falls?
World attraction. So we were in the area, so we just came down.
You guys ever been to the States?
Yes, 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 yes.
You gone lately?
Yes, yes, yes.
What was it like for you crossing the border? How was it? How were you treated?
Oh, very well, very well. Very well, yeah, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
What did they ask you? Do you remember?
No, nothing.
Ask anything?
Nope.
Did you notice anything? Anybody getting detained or separated?
None of that.
Salem Ali from New York offered his experience going from country to country.
And what brings you out to the falls today?
Just took a day off and took the bring the kids and the family.
So how was it for you crossing the border from the U.S. into Canada?
It was pretty good. I mean, there's no rush. Officer was very polite and nice, and we just got in there very quickly.
How is it going to be for you, do you think, when you go from Canada to the U.S.?
It's just going home. I don't think there's an issue.
And they treat you nice? I mean, are they courteous to you as much going there as coming here?
I've been living there forever. It's pretty much okay with us.
I'd like to note that a middle-aged woman from London didn't want to talk. She didn't want to get herself into trouble, she said. When I asked a young Indian couple about their experience, they also declined the interview. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
Now we go to our conversation about the Gary Public Transportation Corporation on a special day. Today is a very busy day for the GPTC. It's a transportation day, at the Lake County Fairgrounds. There's been a change in the leadership at the top of the operation of the Gary Public Transportation Corporation. Let's find out more about it. First, we'll check in with David Wright. He's in charge of marketing and promotions for the GPTC and the incoming general manager for the Gary Public Transportation Corporation, Jerome Parker. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Jerome, let's turn it over to you. Tell us about yourself. I understand you're actually coming back into Northwest Indiana with your return in charge at the GPTC.
Yeah, that is correct. I'm originally from Gary, Indiana, and I actually started off with Gary Public Transit back in 1979 as a bus operator.
Mm-hmm.
I drove a bus for about 6.5 years and then got promoted into management side of the transit system here. And I was here until October of 1998, and I had the golden opportunity of going to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, to be the general manager for the transit system there. From Myrtle Beach, I went to Detroit and operated one of their transit locations. And I was there for 3 years, then left Detroit and was transferred to Houston, Texas, where I operated the commuter bus service for 3 years. I had 11 of the terminals in Houston. I was there for about 3 years, and then I got transferred back to Detroit to run the People Mover, which is the light rail automatic train system that runs in downtown Detroit. I was there again for about 3 years and got transferred to Athens, Georgia,
mm-hmm.
and ran the transit system in Athens for about a year. And then after a year in Athens, I got a golden opportunity to go to Atlanta, Georgia, and help start up the regional commuter bus system in Atlanta, Georgia. And I was there for approximately 14 years. I left there back in 2014 and went to Decatur, Illinois to run the transit system there. And that contract expired not too long ago, a couple of months ago. And I had an opportunity to look at the local paper in Gary and saw that they were looking for a general manager. And I was always hoping that one of the opportunities I would get is to actually possibly retire at the place that I started. So I'm getting an opportunity to actually do that, and I'm excited about it.
Well, it's glad that you're coming back to Northwest Indiana, and you've seems that your resume shows that you have a myriad of experience in all kinds of public transportation operations, from buses to commuter lines to light rail lines to just about everything in here that you could possibly imagine. I imagine that probably puts you not only in good stead to know how the Gary system works, but maybe to look to the future for some improvements.
Oh, without question. Well, I want to bring some of that information that I've obtained over the 40 years that I've been in the transit system and do everything I can to add some additional service and things of whatever pops up for the local system here.
Jerome and David, I'll take it over to you now to talk about some of the things that are on the table right now for the Gary Public Transportation Corporation. What are some of the major projects that are underway right now, and how are they coming along?
Well, right now we're trying to continue the momentum that we started in 2018. We experienced a 4.6% increase in ridership in 2018. A lot of that was guided and spearheaded by our launch of the Broadway Metro Express.
Mm-hmm.
That was a collaborative effort. If you've been reading any of the media about that, we could not have done that alone. We had the Indiana Department of Transportation involved, the city of Gary, the town of Merrillville, Ivy Tech was involved, the Legacy Foundation was involved in artwork at the shelters. I think because of that collaborative effort, we were able to achieve our goals of increasing ridership, not just on Broadway, but on the entire system. We also added a mobile app component to our fare collection infrastructure, and that's been a lot more popular than we anticipated. About 6% of our ridership actually is paying for their bus passes and fare cards through our mobile app. So we appreciate the the welcoming posture that it seems like our ridership, both those who have been riding for a while and those who have started riding recently, the way they've embraced some of the changes that we've made.
Have you found that all of this expansion, in particular the Broadway Express, is helping to not only help the entire system grow because you're expanding out of Gary to Merrillville and now down towards Crown Point, but you're also just taking on the rest of the region since this regional transportation has pretty much gone away?
Say that in terms of regional transportation organizations.
Yeah.
But we've been doing regional transit since 1996, when we were able to partner with East Chicago Transit and the former Hammond Transit System for the Tri-City Connection. I mean, we started connecting communities way back then. So what we're doing now is kind of a continuation of a stance that, you know, regional transportation is something needed in the Gary area in Northwest Indiana. And this is just a maturation of something that, you know, ourselves and our transportation partners began a couple of decades ago. So we've of the opinion that, you know, regional transportation, regional transit itself never left. We're just doing it in a way that we think is a bit more sustainable and kind of create some momentum.
looking at the future, what kind of projects are you all looking at? And then obviously that's what you get to help do, Jerome, in taking over as the new GM. What would you like to do in the future that would expand the GPTC system and include all the other communities beyond what you've already done?
We've got a couple of projects that are on the table, very, very coming up very, very quickly. One of the things that we wanted to talk about in particular today is an effort that we thought was going to be tabled for 2019, but fortunately, because of partnerships, again, we were able to keep going.
Oh.
That is our transit service to the Lake County Fair. We've been doing that for about 6 or 7 years now. It's another collaboration with North Township Dial-A-Ride in the Hammond area, East Chicago Transit. Everybody counts for Center for Independent Living, which is an advocacy organization that we've been partnering with for a while. We were able to resurrect that effort in large part because of the addition of the Legacy Foundation as another partner. They have agreed to sponsor this year's Transit Day. It will be on August 8th, and on that day we will be running a special service that connects the Northern Lake County Transit agencies, including our service, East Chicago Transit Service, and North Township Dial-A-Ride, and providing trips down to the Lake County Fair for just a dollar.
That's great. That's great. Tell us about the route that is set up for that very special day coming up.
Well, the route primarily takes State Route 55 between the Ridge Road Corridor and the Lake County Fairgrounds. It will be leaving the Walmart area in Southern Hammond, going through Griffith Plaza, and then down 55 mm-hmm. towards the county complex, where we'll meet up with some of our shuttle routes that connect the Broadway Metro Express to Northern Crown Point, and from there down to the Lake County Fairgrounds. It's something that some of the veterans of Transit Day, in terms of riders, have come to expect, and we're really, really happy that we're able to continue that this year. We really appreciate the desire on the part of the Legacy Foundation to provide some additional funding to help us do it. The way that it's set up, we're able to connect with North Township Dial-A-Ride service area as well as East Chicago Transit service area. So those agencies aren't going to be changing up any of their operations. They're just going to be able to meet up with our Lake County Fair service. So that way, that one additional route can connect to our system, East Chicago system, and North Township system, and reach all the way down to Southern Crown Point.
Well, it sounds like with this very special day coming up and the opportunity to continue what you were able to do to start last year and to continue on for this year as well, it's going to make a lot of people happy, especially if they've been wanting to make it down to the fair, but they don't have the real transportation efforts to be able to do so. They can catch a bus and from wherever they happen to be in North Lake County and move their way south down into Crown Point.
That's true. That's true. Or if they just don't want to deal with the traffic.
Which is very possible, too, because with the construction and all, that's always going to be a problem, we know.
Mm-hmm.
Now that we know that what the plans are going to be for this very special day coming up for the Lake County Fair, what other items are on the agenda for GPTC coming up here for the rest of this year and going into next?
There are a couple of things that we are continuing to develop in terms of trying to bring Northwest Indiana's transit infrastructure into the 21st century. We are hoping to get some good news about taking a portion of our system, particularly the Broadway corridor, into a more sustainable fuel structure. We have applied for a grant from the state to make the Broadway corridor and the Broadway Metro Express a zero emissions corridor
mm-hmm.
by incorporating electric buses. So if we're able to get that grant, we'll be able to replace, for the most part, the entirety of that fleet with electric vehicles. That will make that corridor even more ecologically and sustainably sound. We already have solar-lit bus shelters on the corridor, so it's already something that we've got in mind for that corridor. We're also looking into, we've just already received a federal funding designation to convert our maintenance facility to solar power.
Well, it sounds like you've had some great plans ahead. And what's been the response so far from GPTC passengers about the new solar lit stations that are out there?
Well, the stations themselves, we've got a good, a good response mm-hmm. from most of the passengers. They wanted to see us upgrade our infrastructure. They wanted to see more shelters, on the Broadway corridor. So we're happy that they've been received. The artwork's been well received. The lighting's been well received. We do like getting the checks from the advertising panels that are on, yeah. on those same bus shelters.
Yes.
Local money is always great, and those are, I think we've got, all of those are fully leased out. So the advertisers in Northwest Indiana have been responding to that opportunity to advertise to our riders. The electric vehicles, we haven't been broadcasting that as much now because we don't know if we're going to get that money yet.
Mm-hmm.
But once we do have that in hand, we'll start that we'll start that acquisition in earnest. And the opportunity to take our maintenance facility to a more sustainable future, I think just makes the entirety of the region benefit, because it will reduce, you know, our fossil footprint, our carbon footprint, and it will maybe reduce the cost of operations for the entire system.
Well, David, it sounds like you, as well as your new boss, Jerome Parker, there at GPTC, have some great projects underway, some great ideas for the near future with this very special transit day at the Lake County Fair coming up Thursday, August 8th, and for the future in general for the mass transit systems here in Northwest Indiana. Thanks for being with us to talk about this, and we hope that lots of people take advantage of the very special rides that they can make to head from wherever they happen to be in the north part of the county down to the county fairgrounds. Thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
We really appreciate it. Anyone who has any questions on it can contact us at 885-7555 extension 0, or they can look us up at GaryTransit.com or Gary Transit on both Twitter and Facebook.
That's David Wright. He is in marketing, GPTC in Gary, and along with his new boss, the incoming general manager, Jerome Parker. And since our conversation, we've gotten word that the GPTC has picked up the funding as part of the Volkswagen settlement to be able to purchase 2 solar-powered buses. Thanks to our reporters on the program today, to Meredith Coleus-Pete and Hannah Reed from the Post Tribune, to Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson, and again, thanks to David Wright and Jerome Parker from the Gary Public Transportation Corporation. And thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today. We'll be back with you on Monday.